Let's go to Genesis 37 this morning, please. Genesis 37. As often happens with my brain, I forgot to round off the message last week. I told you I was going to point out why there was this structural theme of journeys and then death. And you probably picked up on the general idea of it, but after I finished, I thought, oh no, I didn't circle around back to it again. But you probably figured out that in Genesis 35, when you had the journey and then death, journey, spiritual ruin, journey, death, I think the interspersing of traveling across our planet with problems is a reminder that you cannot get away from problems no matter where you go. But you also can't get away from the blessing of God if you're in covenant with Him. And so I think that's why Moses arranged it the way that he did in Genesis 35. You say, Pastor Michael, you told us Genesis 37. Are you losing it? No, I am losing it in some respects. I am going to be in Genesis 37 here. We're going to just briefly note a couple things out of chapter 36, not because it's inconsequential. All scripture is inspired by God. But I just want to point out the basic theme of chapter 36, because chapter 36 focuses on Esau. Esau, and it's kind of odd to us because he's not the one in the covenant, but God has promised him a blessing, and chapter 36 shows us that God fulfills this blessing to Esau because he moves away and goes to Edom. Do you remember what promise that would fulfill? Remember when Jacob stole Esau's blessing and he says, isn't there a blessing for me? And he says, well, you get a secondary one. I'm paraphrasing. You get a secondary one. It's not as good because you're not in covenant, but it is a blessing nonetheless. In chapter 27, verse 40, his father told him, your brother you shall serve. That's not the blessing so much, but it says, but it shall come about when you become restless, you will break his yoke from your neck. So really, I think the purpose of chapter 36 is to show us that God kept his blessing, his promise of blessing to Esau as well. We'll see the promise kept to Jacob over the last 14 chapters of the book, starting in verse 1 of chapter 37. Jacob lived in the land where his father had sojourned, in the land of Canaan. These are the records of the generations of Jacob. Title of my message this morning is, who's in charge around here? Who's in charge around here? Have you ever walked into a workplace and wondered that? Maybe you didn't have the audacity to ask that question, but you wondered, who's in charge around here? Maybe if we walked into some of your homes right now and saw the condition of your home, we would say, who's in charge around here? Now, that happens on Sundays. I get it. You're scrambling to get out. But sometimes in life, don't you wonder who's in charge? I mean, you know it theologically, right? But practically speaking, you wonder. Don't raise your hand on this because I'm not trying to embarrass anybody, although you might wear it with a badge of honor. I don't know. How many of you like to feel in control? Okay, don't put your hands up, but you're probably thinking. Don't be thinking about your wife or husband here. Okay, I didn't ask about them. I asked about you. We like to feel secure and in control. Some of you ladies, if your to-do list doesn't get done during the day, you just don't feel good. You have a hard time. Some of you men, you got all these things you want to get done at work or around the home on your day off, the honey-do list, and if you don't get it done, you're just restless. Or if you feel vulnerable, or you are working for somebody, you're not in management, you're not the boss. Sometimes our hearts tend towards anxiety because we like to feel in control. And sometimes this is where, for instance, the so-called eating disorders come from. It's a way of control. Sometimes people cut themselves because they feel in control. It manifests itself in different ways in our heart, but generally speaking, we like to feel like we're in control. But isn't that an illusion? Are you ever really in control? The point I want to make this morning from Genesis 37 is that you are not in control, and that's actually a very good thing. Because as we're going to watch here unfold in the life of Joseph, he's not in control, And on the surface, we think, oh, bad. But as the story plays out, we'll find out that Joseph was not in control. God was, and that was just the way it ought to be. Verses 1 to 4 describe Joseph's dad's favoritism and Joseph's brother's hatred. Three words I want you to think of today. Number one, favoritism. Number one, favoritism. Verse 1 tells us that God had kept his promises to Jacob, brought him back to the land of Canaan, but the promises are yet unfulfilled because he's still a sojourner. He doesn't own much of the land. God hasn't fulfilled all his promises yet. Verse 2 tells us, Joseph, when he was 17 years of age, was pasturing the flock with his brothers while he was still a youth. Some of you are 17 and you feel really old. 16, 17, those are big birthdays. According to the Bible, you're still really young. I feel that too. Joseph, 17 years old, helping his brothers. Joseph's not in control. See what happens. Along with the sons of Bilhah, the sons of Zilpah. Bilhah's sons were who? Well, the number 5 and 6 sons, Dan and Naphtali. Zilpah's sons were who? Number 7 and 8, Gad and Asher. So these are the sons of the concubines. God doesn't endorse polygamy. He makes it very clear in Genesis 2 what his view of that is. But even those that knew the Lord, sadly, often practice it to the demise of their own families. Verse 2 tells us Joseph is helping them. It says he brought back a bad report about them to their father. Verse 2. What was the bad report? Were the brothers lazy? Were they stealing some of the sheep for themselves? Were they talking dirty? Were they slandering their dad? Moses doesn't tell us. But Joseph brings a bad report back. Now, I want you to be careful here because initially, some of you, you're going to think, well, Joseph's just being a tattletale. Bad Joseph, bad. You know you don't do that. You talk to the brothers first. Well, number one, how do we know that Joseph didn't talk to the brothers first? And number two, would they have responded to Joseph? Based on how they respond to him in the rest of the chapter, these aren't the most reasonable brothers. Plus, I know of no biblical principle that says if somebody sins in general, it's not a direct sin against you, but somebody sins in general, that you have to talk to them first. Now, generally, it's a good idea, but I know of no biblical principle that teaches that. Now, if they've sinned against you directly, sure, Matthew 18. So before we pile on Joseph, I'm not sure that Joseph sinned here. In fact, I think he was probably doing the right thing to tell his father. But of course, the brothers, they don't like Joseph, as we'll see, so they don't respond properly. Verse 3, Israel loved Joseph more than all his sons because he was the son of his old age and he made him a multicolored tunic. But his brothers saw that their father loved him more than all his brothers, so they hated him. They could not speak to him on friendly terms. Jacob's favorite wife, of course, was Rachel. She's dead by now. She died when Joseph was no more than 10 years old, so she's been dead for at least 7 years. But the favorite wife produced the favorite son. You remember, Jacob's parents played favorites, didn't they? Yeah, one of them liked Jacob better, one of them liked Esau better, so Jacob continued the tradition. And to show his favoritism to Joseph, he gave him this multicolored tunic. Now, some translations might say long-sleeved robe. You say, which one is right? The simple question is we don't know. This Hebrew word only shows up 2 times in the entire Bible, here in chapter 37 and in 2 Samuel 13:19, where Tamar, the virgin daughter of King David, was wearing tunic, multicolored tunic perhaps, or long-sleeved robe. Whatever it was, if a king's daughter was wearing it, we know it was very beautiful, probably a sign of royalty or special privilege. So, I'm thinking what's going on here is that Joseph has been placed in some sort of leadership role over his brothers. He's not just common staff. Joseph is in middle management. And to show that, his dad gives him this multicolored coat, the sign of preference and royalty. And his brothers, somewhat understandably, don't like it. Don't raise your hand on this one, but how many of us as humans just love having authority over us? When you go to the polls to vote, how many of you are just fired up thinking, I'm going to get a leader over me that I really want to follow? We don't like leadership in general, especially when it involves submitting to someone who is either younger than us or maybe not as educated as we are, maybe not as gifted as we are. This happens in the workplace all the time. I mean, I look back on it, and when you called me to be your pastor, to take Pastor Bud's place, when he moved up to Edmonton, remember how old I was? 28. And I look back on that now, and I think, wow, I was really young. It's hard to submit to someone who is younger than you, and the brothers are struggling with that. But notice the favoritism of Jacob. And parents, there are many motivations for living a consistent Christian life. And here's another one. If you don't live a consistent Christian life, your children probably won't either. I'm not saying if your children make bad decisions, it's your fault. But if you don't live a consistent Christian life, your children probably won't either. There are exceptions like Joseph, but Jacob is a very inconsistent believer, isn't he? And no surprise, most of his children follow suit. Now, God's not done with the family, but this is a motley crew, to say the least. Look at verse 4. His brothers saw that their father loved him more than all his brothers, and so they hated him. They could not speak to him peaceably, on friendly terms, in shalom. They couldn't speak in shalom to him. They hated him. Notice here that it became evident to the brothers who was the favorite. On occasion, our kids will come to us and say to one of us, to Lisa or myself, tongue in cheek, I think, but they'll say, Daddy, who's your favorite kid? Am I your favorite? And all of us know the right answer at that point, correct? We love you all the same. You all are very dear to us. We all know the right answer, but do you live it out in your home? It's easy to gravitate to the kid who has your same personality, your same interests, and to stay at a distance with those that maybe have a different personality or different interests. Our affection is revealed by our actions as parents. You can say till you're blue in the face, I love you all equally, but do your actions reveal that affection to your kids? Maybe you've got a kid that's struggling academically, spiritually. Does your affection, is that shown by the actions and your attitudes towards that child? Jacob's actions revealed his heart. His actions revealed his favoritism. Would your children see by your actions that you love them all? They're all special to you. Our affection is revealed by our actions, but our resentment is also revealed by our actions. That's what the brothers demonstrate here. They hated him. They resented him. They could not speak to him in peace. Their hatred was revealed by their tongues. Friends, please don't ever say something like, I know I said that, but I didn't mean it. That's baloney. You said it because you meant it. Now, you regret now that you didn't pause to filter it through biblical principles before you said it, but what comes out is just a reflection of what's in the heart. So the brothers' hearts of resentment is coming out in what they say. They couldn't talk to him. Understand this principle in families and offices, for that matter, sports teams, friendships, churches. Favoritism almost always results in strife. Favoritism usually results in strife. The brothers grew to resent Joseph. if there's constant strife in your home, I mean, all of us have strife, right? We're sinners, and you put a bunch of sinners under one roof, and that's a recipe for disaster. All of us have strife at times, but if you just have constant strife, hour after hour after hour, day after day after day, what is that evidencing? It's evidencing a lack of love. Hatred results in strife. Love results in peace. So in verses 5 to 11, I want you to think about the second key word today, jealousy. Jealousy. Number one, favoritism. Number two, jealousy. At this point, I hope you're not saying, Pastor Michael, are you talking to our family? I might be. God is, but I don't have anybody in mind here. I just know that Scripture is pertinent to all of our lives. Verses 5 to 11, Joseph's brothers hate Joseph for his dreams. Verse 5, Joseph had a dream. We say, big deal. I have dreams all the time. One of you was telling me about your dream before the service here. You thought I was mad at you, and you woke up wanting to punch me. Well, I'm glad that dreams aren't reality. But in this day, remember, before the Bible was completed, God did speak to people, to believers, through dreams. So God is speaking to Joseph, but the brothers don't like it. Joseph had a dream, and when he told it to his brothers, they hated him even more. So the resentment and the jealousy continues to grow. So he gives them two dreams. Most of you are probably familiar with them, but if you're not, the first dream has to do with sheaves of grain. And Joseph's sheaf in the dream stands up straight, and the other sheaves bow down. The brother's sheaves bow down. Well, Joseph's brothers don't like this. Verse 8, his brothers said to him, are you actually going to reign over us? Are you actually going to rule over us? So they hated him even more for his dreams and for his words. Joseph's brothers don't think, or they at least don't want to acknowledge that the dream is from God, so they resent the thought that this little pipsqueak is going to rule over them one day. Because they hate Joseph, and so they hate him all the more. God's not done yet. So he gives Joseph a second dream, and this one involves the celestial bodies, where the sun and the moon and 11 stars bow down to Joseph. Jacob recognizes that the sun represents him as the father, the moon represents his mother. You say, wait a second, I thought his mother was dead. Well, it could be talking about the concubine Bilhah, or it could be saying that Joseph is going to become more important than even his mom, anybody in his family. The 11 stars, of course, represent his 11 brothers. So, verse 10, Joseph related it to his father and his brothers. His father rebuked him, said to him, what is this dream you have had? Shall I and your mother and your brothers actually come to bow down ourselves before you to the ground? His brothers were jealous of him, but his father kept the saying in mind. Jacob recognizes that perhaps this is really from God. Now he rebukes Joseph, but as he ponders it, it says he keeps it in mind. A dream, significant. Two dreams, really significant. What is God doing here with Joseph? Because really the next 22 years of Joseph's life are a disaster. God is making promises to Joseph to get him through those next 22 years. God makes a promise to Joseph, Joseph, I'm going to exalt you above your entire family. One day your brothers, your mom, and your dad are going to come and they're going to bow down to you. Joseph probably doesn't understand the complete significance of this, but God is choosing Joseph to rule over his family. And perhaps Jacob gives it a second look because wasn't that what happened with Jacob and his older brother Esau? Whom did God choose to serve whom? The elder to serve the younger. Verse 12. His brothers went to pasture their father's flock in Shechem. Verses 12 to 17 will show us that Joseph is going to search for his brothers here at his father's request. Family was living down in Hebron, which is down in the southern Israel below Jerusalem. Shechem, of course, is where the tragic rape of his sister had happened. So One question that came to my mind is, why go back to Shechem? Strange decision. But they're about 75 kilometers from Shechem. And Jacob tells Joseph, verse 13, aren't they pasturing the flock in Shechem? Come, I'll send you to them. And he said, I'll go. So he obeys. Then he said to him, go now and see about the welfare of your brothers, the welfare of the flock. Bring word back to me. So he sent him from the valley of Hebron. He came to Shechem. It seems to indicate to me that Joseph is in a leadership position over his brothers. He's not out with them on the field. He's bringing reports. Joseph, as an obedient son, is willing to go. And so he goes to Shechem, but what do you know? They're not there. Verse 15, a man found him, and behold, he was wandering in the field. Poor Joseph, pre-GPS days, doesn't know where to go. The man asked him, what are you looking for? He said, I'm looking for my brothers. Please tell me where they are pasturing the flock. The man said, they moved from here, for I heard them say, let's go to Dothan. So Joseph went after his brothers and found them at Dothan. Some of us are as bad at Israelite geography as Americans are at Canadian geography. And you say, I have no idea where Dothan is. Well, you just keep going from Shechem, about 22 kilometers further up towards the Mount Carmel area, the Valley of Armageddon, that area. And he finds them. I want you to think very carefully about the key truth I pointed out at the beginning, that Joseph is not in control. What if the circumstances are just a little bit different? What if, just coincidentally, that guy doesn't find Joseph wandering in the field? What if he came down that path 5 minutes later and missed Joseph? Well, humanly speaking, Joseph doesn't find his brothers. The tragedy that unfolds in this section doesn't happen. And Joseph goes back home and lives the next 22 years at home in peace. We say, great, or maybe not. Because sometimes trials are the way that God fulfills his promise to us. So what we look at just coincidentally, oh, too bad. Now, this is just fate or luck or bad circumstances. Or maybe Joseph was just a little too persistent for his own good. God is in control of all of this, unfolding his plan, even though Joseph has no idea what he's walking into. Verse 18, when they saw him from a distance, before he came close to them, they plotted against him to put him to death. Nice guys. They said to one another, here comes this dreamer, let's kill him. We'll throw him into one of the pits and we'll say, a wild beast devoured him. Then let us see what will become of his dreams. They say, let's just get rid of Joseph once and for all. Ironically, the brothers' plan to exterminate Joseph and his dreams are actually what God uses to fulfill his plan. It's not usually a good idea to try and thwart God's sovereign will, as the brothers found out. But shock of all shocks, a surprising brother comes to Joseph's rescue. Verse 21, Reuben heard this. Reuben? No way. Reuben's the oldest, right? What has Reuben just done? He's just committed immorality with one of his dad's concubines. No way Reuben's going to care for Joseph, but God can use anybody he wants to. So look at verse 21. He rescued them out of their hands and said, let's not take his life. Reuben further said to them, shed no blood. Throw him into this pit that's in the wilderness, but don't lay hands on him. And Moses adds here that he might rescue him out of their hands and restore him to his father. Reuben doesn't want Joseph to die. He doesn't want to be responsible for that. So he comes up with another plan. Let's throw him into this pit. So the pit probably was a cistern. Any of you have a cistern in your backyard? Well, not exactly. You might have a rain barrel. But this was probably much bigger than a rain barrel. You can go, if we have the privilege to go to Israel someday, you can go down there by the Dead Sea and look at the cistern, and it's about as deep as a big swimming pool. So they would collect the runoff rainwater into one of these cisterns, but because often they don't get much rain for 8 or 9 months of the year, they would dry out. So apparently that's what this is. This is a dried out cistern, but a big pit, like a dungeon. So they put him down there. There's no way he can get out. Reuben thinks, I'll come back later when nobody's paying attention. I'll rescue Joseph. I'll take him home, and everything will be honky-dory. Well, everything is not honky-dory because the brothers do something while Reuben is away. Verse 23 came about when Joseph reached his brothers. They stripped Joseph of his tunic, the multicolored tunic that was on him. They took him. They threw him into the pit. The pit was empty without any water in it. They sat down to eat a meal, and as they raised their eyes and looked, behold, what luck! A caravan of Ishmaelites was coming from Gilead with their camels bearing aromatic gum and balm and myrrh on their way to bring them down to Egypt. So Judah, this is number four son, said to his brothers, what profit is it for us to kill our brother and cover up his blood? Let's make some money off of him. Come, let us sell him to the Ishmaelites, not lay our hands on him. He's our brother, our own flesh. So the brothers listened to him. And then the Midianite traders passed by, so he pulled him up and lifted Joseph out of the pit, sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver. So they brought Joseph down to Egypt. So they separate him from their father's symbol of favoritism. They're like, we're taking this coat. The brothers somehow think it's okay to sell their brother into slavery as long as they don't kill him. At least they have some standards, I suppose. And they sell him to these Ishmaelite or Midianite traders. You say, are they Ishmaelites or are they Midianites? And the answer is yes, they are. Midian was Ishmael's younger half-brother. So, you know who they sell Joseph to? Don't miss this. They sell him to relatives. These are probably their second or third cousins. Now, you don't always even know your second or third cousins unless you've gone on Ancestry DNA or something and you see fourth cousin once removed. They probably never met these guys before, but they just happened to pass by. They're on their way from northeastern Israel, like the Golan Heights. They're headed down across to the coastal highway down to Egypt. And they just happen to pass by at the time that Reuben is not with the other brothers. And so they sell him for the price of a common slave, 20 shekels of silver. Verse 29, Reuben came back to the pit and Joseph wasn't there. So Reuben tore his garments. He returned to his brothers and said, the boy is not there. As for me, where am I to go? He says, I'm the oldest. What am I going to do? I'm already on the outs with Dad because of chapter 35. I'm responsible for Joseph's safety. You guys are killing me, Reuben says. So now they've got a plan to cover up their sin. So verse 31, they took Joseph's tunic, slaughtered a male goat, dipped the tunic in blood. They sent the multicolored tunic and brought it to their father and said, we found this. Please examine it to see whether it's your son's tunic or not. He examined it and said, it is my son's tunic. A wild beast has devoured him. Joseph has surely been torn to pieces. So Jacob tore his clothes, put sackcloth on his loins, and mourned for his son many days. All his sons and all his daughters arose to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted, and he said, surely I will go down to Sheol, the grave. I'll go down to the grave and mourning for my son. So his father wept for him. Third word I want you to see here in this passage is sovereignty. See, I never saw that word in this passage, Pastor Michael. Oh, it's there. It's all over the place. Sovereignty, or you might say control. You are not in control, but God is. Jacob was not in control. Joseph was not in control. Ultimately, the brothers weren't in control. We notice here favoritism, number one, jealousy, number two. Number three is the only way you can deal with numbers one and two. I think what this passage is showing us, friends, is you can't control how your parents treat you. Right? Was Joseph at fault for the favoritism? Not at all. It wasn't his fault. Could he control the jealousy and hatred of his brothers? Not at all. We don't see anything that Joseph did to exacerbate it. So number three is how you deal with numbers one and two. If you don't understand God's sovereign control, then these things will drive you literally crazy. when you come to the recognition that you can't control what other people do to you, what family God put you in. I mean, what decision did you have and what family you ended up at? Zilch, zero. What control do you have over how people treat you at work? Very little. You say, I think I'm a pretty nice guy, but nobody else at work seems to think that. What gives? You can't control what other people do to you. Joseph couldn't control it, but would he get the point that God was still in control? You say, well, how could he, Pastor Michael? He's only 17. Would God have allowed this in Joseph's life if Joseph wasn't ready to handle it? Not if we take verses like 1 Corinthians 10 seriously, that there always is a way to escape. You say, well, Joseph didn't escape. That's not the kind of escape I'm talking about. A spiritual escape. So Joseph's brothers deceive their father. The heartlessness of this is tragic. The brothers are scoundrels, by and large. You notice there's one brother that we don't see involved in this? Who's that? Joseph's younger brother, Benjamin. Doesn't appear he has any part in this. Verse 36, things go from bad to worse for poor Joseph. He's 17 down in Egypt, hearing a language he doesn't speak, not knowing if he's going to survive, let alone see his family again. Verse 36, meanwhile, the Midianites sold him in Egypt to Potiphar, Pharaoh's officer, the captain of the bodyguard. So he's working for a government official in a pagan land. And by working for, that's a euphemism for, is a slave to. Joseph's not in control, but God is. God's going to use the brother's sin to fulfill his plan for Joseph. So for the next 22 years, think about what these choices bring in this family. God's in control, but he's not responsible for the evil. But think about the choices that the brothers have made. Jacob says, I'm going to sorrow, and he does for 22 years. What a miserable home this would have been for the next 22 years. Jacob's sorrowing, his favorite son is dead, he thinks. By the way, it's interesting that he, when he stole the blessing, how did he deceive his father? By putting on skins of goats, and he got deceived by the blood of goats. Interesting that deceivers get deceived. Jacob reaped what he sowed. But Jacob will be in sorrow for the next 22 years. What will the brothers be in? Guilt. We find out later that they're blaming everything bad in their life on what they did. This is because we did it to Joseph. We heard his crying, and we didn't deliver him. We're such scoundrels, and the gods are repaying us. So they're going to live for the next 22 years in guilt. What's Joseph going to live in? Slavery. But who's the only one who's free? Joseph. Why? Because he is the only one that really gets God's control. And he's 17 years old. So young people, please don't use the excuse, well, I'm just a teenager. You're going to have to deal with it. Joseph was just a teenager, but he was the most godly one in his family. The big truth of this passage, I think, is this, friends. You don't determine God's sovereign will for your life. You might think you do, but this is a reality check. You don't. You don't, and I do not, determine God's sovereign will for my life. I don't know where I'm going to be in 10 years. I hope I'm here. I don't know if I'm going to be here, or if I'm going to be in heaven, or if I have a debilitating accident. I don't know where I'm going to be in 10 years. I don't determine God's sovereign will. I don't control what other people do to me. I had no control over this birthday present today. I'm thankful for it. But I had no control of it. I had no knowledge of it. That's our lives. We don't determine God's sovereign will. But here's the encouragement, friends. You can obey God's revealed will. We're so worried about God's sovereign will. I want this to change. And God says, you know what I want you to worry about? I've got the sovereign part all under my control. But what I want you to do as my child, whether you're 17 or 70 or somewhere in between, is I want you to obey my revealed will, which in context most of the time means trusting my control. You want to be in control. I want to be in control. Your cat will remind you that you're not in control. Your kids will remind you that you're not in control. Your teachers will remind you that you are not in control. You don't waltz into your classroom and sit down wherever you want. At least that's not the way it worked in my school. We had assigned seats. Do they still do that? Assigned seats. You couldn't sit with your friends. You go in for a test, and you know what? You have no control over what's on that test unless you're a cheater. You have no control over what's on that test. You say, so I throw up my hands and say, forget it. No, what'd you do? You did what you could do, which was study. Or in a soccer game. Carson and I got to practice with the Faith Baptist men's soccer team when we were down in Iowa a couple weeks ago, and it was a lot of fun. Fun being very painful. Illustrate, think of God's sovereignty this way. You, when you're preparing for a soccer game, you have no control over what that other team's going to do, right? You don't know whether they're going to foul you. You don't know what their formation's going to be. You have no control over what they're going to do, but what can you control? You can prepare the best you can and then try and execute it when game time comes. That's how you have to view God's sovereignty. It's not a perfect illustration of it, but you don't have control over what God is doing. He's God. You don't have control over what the other people in your life are doing. Some of you are saying, yeah, if you lived in my home, I want to really say amen, but I can't. You can't control what other people do, but you can't control how you prepare and respond. And Joseph was ready. He had no idea what he was walking into. You don't have any idea what you're walking into this week, circumstantially. But are you ready? Say, how would I know? Right now, are you in the moral will of God? If you're not, you're not ready. And those circumstances of life that come, they're going to blow you away. But if, like Joseph, like our Lord Jesus, you are surrendered to the Father's sovereign will and walking in his moral will, you can make it through 22 years of slavery. Would you bow your heads, please?